Welcome to the podcast, The Storyteller, in which we talk to South Africans who have an interesting story to tell. About 10 years ago, Patrick Ryan changed direction in his life from the world of advertising to wildfire management. After photographing a fire in the Cape, he approached a volunteer wildfire service to document their work on the fire line. But he had to first undergo fire safety training, and this ignited a new passion.
So I joined up and I started doing the training, and I found I absolutely loved it. It kind of ticked a lot of boxes for me. I've always been quite an outdoor adventurous person. And so I completed the training program, joined the organization, and then found myself out as a firefighter almost as much as a photographer. And I moved up into a leadership position in the organization and just carried on going. And then I met a person who's become a friend now in the organization. And together we realized that there was a gap in the wildfire industry for more specialized crews and a higher level and higher standard of crew. So we decided to form a company, and we launched the first specialist crew program in South Africa.
You were on the ground during the fire that had such a devastating impact on the University of Cape Town. What was it like? What was it like being there?
There have been quite a lot of fires in that area. And when I did actually arrive up behind UCT to start taking photographs, I could see that the fire behavior was very intense. It had moved very quickly across from where it started, close to Hospital Bend. It had moved very quickly across the slopes, driven by the northwesterly wind. And there was intense fire behavior when I arrived up there. There was thick smoke. Huge radiant heat coming off the area that was burning, and there were fire whirls going on, which are like sort of whirlwinds of fire under the trees. This was an effect of the northwesterly wind pushing over the slope, the lower slopes of Devil's Peak, and kind of meeting the topography and the valleys that exist in that area. So it was a combination of those two winds were kind of meeting and causing unstable atmosphere under the trees. And so we had firewalls going on and a very fast, very rapid fire spread.
You know, I've sort of seen your pictures, other people's pictures. There's a strange attraction to fire. It's dangerous, but it's beautiful. But we're at a distance. We look at your photographs and we think, oh, beautiful photograph. But I don't think we actually know what it's like to be in the heart of that inferno.
It can get extreme. We have ember showers, huge radiant heat pouring off that fire that you're feeling. The smoke is choking. I mean, when you get a waft of smoke over you, you can't breathe properly. There have been times when I've been stuck in the middle of a wash of smoke coming over, and all I can do is just hit the ground and lie down, trying to get some fresh air at the ground, because I know that the smoke will pass or the wind will change direction and it'll lift and I'll be able to get up and move around again. But it is very, very intense. It's not an area that if you should go into if you're not trained. Wildfire can move extremely quickly. It reacts to topography and wind and the type of vegetation. And those all have an impact on the speed and intensity that the fire can move. And people who don't have the ability to read that fire behavior can find themselves in very dangerous positions very, very quickly, which is why we try and keep public away. And the only photographers in that area should really be people who have had training in wildfire behavior.
But with firefighters, they actually are confronting the beast. And I often think it is a David and Goliath kind of fight. The firefighters seem so dwarfed by this battle and in this battle.
Yeah, it very much is like that. But at the same time, what you're doing when you're on the fire line is you're winning small little skirmishes within a large battle, if I want to put it in that kind of context. You are focused on particular tactics of securing a short area of fire line using beaters, or so either directly beating the flame down with beaters or using water, or cutting vegetation away and creating a break and allowing which will allow the fire to burn to the break and either lose intensity, or else the firefighters can actually use that break to hold the fire or try and hold the fire with water or sort of hand tools. So it's taken in small steps. This is why a big fire can take days or weeks to actually suppress. And as you go along, sort of knocking the flame down, part of the crew will be fighting the fire and push and sort of suppressing the flame. Other members will be further back, and what they'll do is they'll make sure that the fire doesn't rekindle. This is why you'll have so many different crews responding now and different organizations, is that you've got on one fire line or one flank of a fire, you might have five or six different crews from various different organizations. You've got the hand crews who follow the fire line all the way through the mountains, from the Volunteer Wildfire Services, from NCC Wildfires, from Working on Fire. And then you've also got the brigades, and they all work off vehicles, and they stay primarily, sort of within a sort of so many lengths hose line from the road. They won't go too deep into the bush or up the mountain.
Did we make mistakes in terms of what we should have done? Were issues that we just couldn't control? What were your observations from that point of view?
Yeah, I think it's very important to understand that, fire is a force of nature. It is extremely different to manage or control. Especially when a fire gets large, what happens is that fire, it's not just the flames that are the energy. You've got that whole area that is burnt is generating huge heat, and that heat is drawing in winds, and that is pushing the smoke up out of that area. So that's the area of fire. And that area of fire, as it gets bigger, becomes very, very powerful. It's a very difficult thing to stop. We don't have the resources to stop them easily. And in fact, a large fire like the Knysna fires, you could have had every single firefighting resource in South Africa there on roads trying to hold that. And the power of that energy combined with the wind driving it, it's is unstoppable. Very little will stop it. What will contribute to it stopping and to allowing resources to actually suppress the fire are things like the weather factors changing, the topography becoming in our favor, choosing the right moments to go in. I remember seeing a news report just a day or on the second day of the fire, and the reporter was saying, and it was almost I don't know if it was meant to be sort of critical, but it came across slightly critical, saying, well, the firefighters are waiting for the fire to come down off the mountain. They're not going up, and we've been told they're waiting for the fire to come down off the mountain. And it was, I think, questioning it, but it's a lack of understanding. It's you would waste a lot of time and energy going up the mountain trying to fight that fire in conditions and terrain that are dangerous and would be ineffective and have little result. So by waiting for the fire to come down, you then deal with it on your own terms. So managing wildfire is very much about strategy. So there are three rules when you engage with any incident, but especially wildfire. The first is safety of all responders and public. The second is looking after property, and the third is managing the incident. So there's a priority there, and that's always in the mind of anybody who is managing or overseeing or commanding crews. But what you can't stop is things like ember storms coming off a fire, and that is where most of the damage would have occurred during this fire, would have been the embers flying out of the area of fire across structures and buildings and homes, and they would find vulnerable areas. And when they find a vulnerable area, all they need to do is sit there smoldering away, find some other fuel that they can ignite, and that'll then increase exponentially until suddenly a roof is on fire, or and then a building's on fire. That is impossible to stop. An ember attack is the main cause of loss of buildings, and I think we'll find when the reports come out that that is what happened with UCT.
So, how is it controlled by the spotter plane? Because there's always a spotter plane right up the top. What is it communicating?
The spotter plane will be communicating to the operations section chief and the incident commander. They'll both be listening on the radio. As soon as there's more than one helicopter in the air, you need to have an aerial management in position. So that's what the spotter is. He's kind of the manager of the aerial resources, and they'll be feeding their observations down to the operations section chief and to the pilots in the helicopters. So it's going to be a sort of a three-way conversation, and likewise the communications will go back that the pilots will pick up that they're not being effective and that they need a hand crew to come in and support them. As it is, just dropping water with helicopters alone won't, it can slow down the spread of a fire, but it won't put a fire out or contain it, unless you're very lucky and the conditions are really in your favor. You have to get those hand crews in to dig up the embers, cut the fire line, and still beat down flame. So, those aerial resources will just suppress the fire to a certain amount. And they will feed that information to the spotter and to the ops chief, and he will likewise say, well, look, work this area of line, or actually, you know what, let that area burn, and let's find an area where we can actually get crew in to support you with that. So on the first day, the helicopters were flying on above the road's memorial side, the Newlands side of the fire, and water bombing there quite a lot. There was a lot less wind there, whereas the wind, sort of a kilometer or so further around the mountain towards the Groote Schuur Hospital was pumping. And that is the strangeness of the, and that's how topography affects wildfire.
The other thing that I wonder about when I see sort of fires being worked is it sounds quite chaotic. You've got all these elements that you're trying to manage, the spotter planes, helicopters, different teams on the ground with different types of equipment, and as you said, in different types of environments. So, how good is our communication to actually make sure that everybody's doing the right thing at the right time?
In the past, yes, it was very complicated. A lot of different organizations all trying to, respond and do their own thing. What has happened is that there's a system called the Incident Command System that's been introduced into South Africa, and this was actually evolved by wildland firefighters in America in response to a similar problem of having lots of different organizations responding to a wildfire. It's one of the hazards where you do have so many different people responding. And they realized that there was a problem with communication. They were having people getting in danger, and they were having losses. They were having losses of home, of life, and resources and stuff. So they evolved this system, which they then perfected. And this actually has been brought into South Africa about 10 years ago, and is slowly being trained up in the country. And the system is a very simple system. It uses management by objectives, and it has a clear chain of command, a clear chain of communication, and a set of features and principles that people get trained up in. So once you know this system, and you don't have to go all the way through learning all the different roles and responsibilities up to the incident commander, you just have to know how the system operates, and that you, as a responder, you will have a supervisor, and essentially that supervisor will have another supervisor and another supervisor above them until you get to the incident commander. And it works very, very well. It is still being trained up in this country, and it's still being implemented, properly in this country. At the moment, as I said, it's still a work in progress. It's definitely we are in a much better place than we were, but we've still got, a way to go to getting this operating perfectly in the country.
I wonder how much priority it's been given because, like so many of our emergency services, I think the fire services, the firemen, the firewomen are so often underrated, underpaid. It's not appreciated that they are actually putting their life at risk.
You're very right. I think fire services and emergency services in this country are underappreciated. The fire services definitely have a better position and are better recognized as far as the official brigades go than the guys who do the wildland firefighting. Wildland firefighters are seen as unskilled labor, essentially, in South Africa, and with a kind of a pay structure that goes along with that. So
That's quite
while there's
shocking.
a It is, and it's for so many different reasons. Historically, wildland firefighting would have been handled by forestry. Forestry was devolved when the governments changed, and it hasn't kind of followed on in the same way. There used to be a big research department, and in overseas, what you'll find is forestry is normally a big driver because they have to protect their assets. They're a big driver of having a wildland firefighting force that's well trained and paid, sort of well paid. And again, this is different in different countries. In fact, in America at the moment, the wildland firefighters are actually almost starting a revolt to say that they need to be recognized. Their risk that they face needs to be recognized, and it's a, they're seeing the same thing as the as we do out here, where the structural firefighters are seem to have a better salary, they're better paid,
These are
and the
the fire
wildland guys
brigades,
are,
municipal fire brigades.
And there's no so there's a career path within the brigades. There's no career path within wildland firefighting. If you want to join and have a career within wildland firefighting, where do you join? If you want to see a career path, there's no real industry to get into. You can go and join a contract crew, but you're never going to really earn a large amount of, or decent amount of money. And that's because of the sort of system that's there. The municipalities don't have the budgets allocated to wildland, to fire suppression, to be able to pay these contract crews what they deserve. The municipalities and the fire services try very hard to get increases, but they come up against, political barriers, and the where the focus of a particular municipality will probably be more on housing and development and skills and education, rather than, sort of looking to put budget into wildland firefighting. So it's in a very strange position in South Africa. Part of our reason to get into this industry, my business partner and I, was to try and create a career path, and we're still very fo sort of we still believe in that. We're still very passionate about seeing that become possible in South Africa, that you can have a career. You can be somebody living in a township who finds a passion in fire, and through training and being upskilled, can actually end up becoming a manager, supervisor, even up to a commander one level. Or you could have somebody in university who decides that they've got a skill set that they want to bring into the wildfire industry, GIS or law or administration, and they would come in and they would offer, have this huge skill set to be able to bring into the wildfire industry and help grow it. And this just isn't there. And our hope is that we will, through and with others helping, one day be able to achieve this and have a proper industry in South Africa with firefighters being recognized, and being able to have a proper career and life out of it.
In the certain regions, we have really devastating wildfires, and other regions not. So there is this kind of lack of knowledge, I think, depending on where you are and how relevant wildfire is in your sort of ecosystem.
What is helping is the social media and communications nowadays are allowing more and more people to see wildfire, to appreciate its impact, and why wildfire. You can't get rid of wildfire. It's about understanding how to manage wildfire in a way that we keep people safe and we allow nature to kind of do what it's meant to do, allow for regeneration of areas for, fire produces ash. Ash brings nutrients back into the soil. So that's a very important part of the process. Without that, the soil can become moribund. So, and the communication and media allows people to understand it more and more. But I still think there's a huge lack of understanding of the danger of fire in the public eye. And at the moment, and nowadays, what you see is a lot of people rushing to a fire to film or video, and take photographs or social media. And this just puts huge pressure on emergency services. They now have to worry about members of the public being in danger, and that is problematic.
What did you call them? Fire chasers. Instagram
Fire
fire
chasers,
chasers. Yeah.
yes. Fire tourists or fire chasers. Myself and Justin Sullivan coined the term fire tourists, and we saw it with a few fires starting probably about 2 years ago on Signal Hill, where there was some fires burning and members of the public in flip-flops and shorts and jeans and t-shirts were getting in amongst the firefighters and getting photographs and videos for their social media accounts and having no realization of the danger that they're potentially were putting themselves in, not understanding that fire moves incredibly quickly uphill. It moves faster uphill than you can run. If you don't understand fire, you can get yourself in a very, very dangerous position. And fire is intensely hot. You know, it's not a braai. The fire can burn up to 1600 degrees Celsius. The radiant heat coming off that is in the hundreds of degrees. If that washes over you, not
It could
even the flame.
literally roast you. I mean,
Yep.
it
You don't even
literally.
need to have direct flame contact. Just that radiant heat washing over you can sear your lungs or sort of burn you to the point where you have third degree burns. And if you have massive of third degree burns, you are yeah, it's life threatening. So there is a big concern around that. And of course, what happens is the fire services are trying to battle the fire and now worry about members of the public. So it's very problematic.
Another thing that you mentioned was that the fires you've noted over the past 8 years, I think, have become more aggressive.
Chatting to an American colleague of mine who's been in fire for the last 40 years, he was saying that since the late 70s, early 80s, the firefighters suddenly picked up a definite increase in intensity. There was more aggressive fire spread. Fires were getting bigger quicker. There were more firewalls and more sort of dangerous fire behavior occurring. And there's kind of been a lag from the northern hemisphere or the sort of northwestern down to us and Australia, but it's definitely here now as well. And we are seeing this in increasing intensity. I mean, there have always been big fires. You know, there was a massive fire that burnt and replicated the Knysna fires back in 1910, I think it was. So there have always been those times when everything kind of aligns and you get these big fires. But what we're seeing is that happening more and more often. We're getting fires getting large and intense very quickly these days. Whereas in the past it was a bit slower in getting to that point. And this is because the climate's getting drier. We're seeing a lot of co seeing seems to be an increased number of cold fronts occurring during the summer, and this means you get very volatile wind conditions. Very difficult to try and suppress a fire when you have a wind that keeps shifting, 180 degrees. It can put you on the back foot very quickly. So that there's definitely a change happening. And as if you can, you speak to any firefighter who's on the ground dealing with this, day to day or out in the field, and they can tell you that they have seen this. They'll tell you they've seen this change occurring. It doesn't matter what is happening. We are getting fed information from scientists and higher levels. We can physically see these changes occurring in front of us.
So then, a service like yours, which is you're a private company specializing in wildfire management, must be important. What kind of client comes to you for assistance?
It's quite a mix. I mean, we work with government, local and district municipalities, and then also private landowners and even homeowners. So it's quite a broad spectrum. I think it's when the it's when the wildfire risk is understood that we get people approaching us. We had some homeowners in Betty's Bay approach us to do wildfire
Because they
risk
had a
assessments and give them a
wildfire,
wildfire
yes,
plan.
after the
Yes, they
effect.
had a, you know, that exactly. And one of the homeowners actually had been in Betty's Bay his entire life. His dad had lived there, and he said he knew there was going to be fires. He'd been telling people around that there will be fires. We have to be ready. But he wasn't getting the support. When that fire happened, he got the support to approach us and get us in to assist with a fire plan and just a risk assessment of the properties. It's vital for people who live in an environment where there can be risk from wildfire to understand that they are at risk and that actually there are things they can do. I think that is the thing. You know, we did the analytical report of Knysna, and from that we saw where people just weren't educated on the risk and the impact that that had. People didn't have insurance, but if they didn't have insurance and they were able to manage their wildfire risk and reduce the possible impact, then they probably most likely wouldn't have lost their homes. There was the very sad loss of the Johnson family out right near where the fire started. This was an engineer who was, moved out into that area. He'd put all sorts of measures in place to be self-sustaining and live within that within an environment. But in interviewing one of his neighbors who'd known him pretty well, he said that they did not, including this guy we interviewed, they did not understand the risk. They didn't realize that wildfire could spread as quickly as it does and the way it does. They saw the glow of the fire on the distant hill, not realizing that the embers were traveling and igniting the hill below them, and then the fire raced up, and by the time they realized they were in danger, they were basically trapped in a situation that they couldn't get out. And very sadly, that entire family lost their life. And as you said, these are the type of people who, if they'd understood their risk, they would have put the measures in place to keep themselves safe. I mean, they could have, looking at where they lived, had they reduced the fuel loading around their house and created sort of a almost a fire bunker, they would have been able to ride out that wave of fire passing through, as people do in Australia, and then come out and, survived. But unfortunately, they just didn't have that understanding or awareness. And that is really what the message we're driving is. It's important to know this. You may not live in a fire area, but you might be traveling through. And if there is a wildfire and you're traveling through that area, do you know what to do? In Australia, there are a lot of programs that drive this kind of awareness. If there is a fire and you're driving on the road, do you know what actions to take to be safe? And this is the message that we're trying very hard to push.
If you want to contact Patrick Ryan, visit vulcanwildfire.co.za. A special thanks to Freesound. This podcast is brought to you by Digital Storyteller.